Well, hey there, all you record nuts. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of The Vinyl Guide. In today's show, we'll talk to Eric Spitznagel, author of the hilarious new book, Old Records Never Die, One Man's Quest for His Vinyl and His Past. This is a book that is especially endearing to record lovers like us, and the amount of work this guy puts into rebuilding his record collection is a story that you don't want to miss. Plus, I'm going to share a little-known secret message that Pink Floyd issued on record. I'll play you the sound clips and tell you where you could find them on your copy. And who else knows what we'll talk about today? I'm just winging it like the rest of you. And it's all thanks to our sponsor, AsTheRecordTurns.com. If you collect records, you need to know about AsTheRecordTurns.com. Kevin and his team do all original pressings, no reissues. So if you are looking for a collectible record, get it today by calling US area code 323-251-4895. And we are also sponsored by GrooveWasher.com. Clean your records and protect your vinyl investment with the GrooveWasher record cleaning system. It's killer, it's effective, and it's only $55 shipped within the USA. Get your starter kit right now at GrooveWasher.com. And now that business is all taken care of, let's talk records.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hey there, peoples. Thanks for joining us. Glad to have you back. I hope you're all well. Look, I'm going to cut right into it. We have a super awesome show for you today. For the first segment, I'm going to be sharing with you some info on a secret message that Pink Floyd put on one of their record albums. Now, at first, I thought I discovered something totally new, something I hadn't read about before. I tried Googling it. I couldn't find any information on it. But once I cleaned up the audio files, I could hear what was happening. It totally makes sense. Well, I should say it totally makes sense in a Pink Floyd sort of way. I'll explain how I found these little messages. I'll play you the clips, and you can check it out for yourselves on any records if you don't believe me. Look, I swear, I haven't been inhaling too much record cleaning fluid. This message does exist, and I'll prove it to you in a few moments. And on the second half of today's show, I'm going to interview Eric Spitznagel. He's the author of this killer new book, Old Records Never Die, One Man's Quest for His Vinyl and His Past. Now, like so many of us, Eric got rid of all his records in the 90s and went on a quest to get them back. Now, not just copies of his old records, he was looking for the exact records that he had in his youth. So it's a killer book. Look, I couldn't put it down. So let's talk to Eric. He'll tell you more about this hilarious journey. Be warned, however, there is explicit language in today's episode. So if you have any kids in the car, you probably want to open the door and boot them out. Let them stick around. They'll maybe learn a little something today. Maybe some new words they can take to school and shout out while the teacher is speaking. Or maybe you could just listen to the podcast a bit later when they're not around. Anyway, if you don't mind a few curse words, especially when they are used hilariously, then you'll enjoy Eric's interview and his book, Old Records Never Die, available from Amazon and any other place that sells analog books. And also a super special thanks to everyone who sent positive notes on last week's episode featuring John Lennon and the Roots and rock and roll albums. The whole story behind those albums to me is absolutely fascinating, and it was fun to track down all the little facts and all the sound bites and the commercials and all the details. So I'm really glad that so many of you enjoyed them as much as I enjoyed putting it together. If you haven't already listened to the episode, please go back, download the episode, and have a listen. And of course, if you enjoy this podcast, there are really three things I ask of you, okay? Number one, support our sponsors. This week, it's AsTheRecordTurns.com and GrooveWasher.com, so that's number one. Number two, support the people that come on this show, like Eric Spitznagel. Check out his book, Old Records Never Die, and of course, some of the other bands and the other groups that we have on the show. Make sure to check them out and support them. And number three, leave me positive iTunes feedback. That helps us reach a wider audience, and it's oh so awesome to be able to do that. So that's all I ask of you. That's all I want you to give me. Other than that, your undying devotion to download this podcast every week and tell your friends. And that's all I'm asking. So I thank you guys in advance for helping me out there. So let's start talking about this secret Pink Floyd message from the wall, right after this message from AsTheRecordTurns.com.
Attention, Vinyl Guide listeners.
Look, I've told you guys before about astherecordturns.com. It's a killer record shop in Hollywood. However, they reach globally, so no matter where you're at in the world, they can help track down original issues and collectible vinyl for your record wish list. Maybe you're looking for a promo copy of an early Stooges LP or a first pressing of your favorite Kiss record. Maybe you'd like an original James Brown on King Records or an OG press of Muddy Waters on Chess Records. Or I know what you're looking for. You're looking for a mono copy of John Coltrane, A Love Supreme, on the Orange Impulse label. Well, whatever it is you're looking for, call Kevin at astherecordturns.com. He can help you find it. Here's the phone number. Grab a pen. U.S. area code 323-251-4895 and tell him that you heard about his shop on the Vinyl Guide. Kevin deals with all original pressings, no reissues. So if you have something on your wish list, or even better yet, if you have a friend or a spouse or a loved one that has a birthday coming up or something you want to celebrate, an anniversary with a song that really means something to you, Kevin can help you sort that out. I mean, who doesn't love to have an original pressing, collector quality vinyl? Now, get your pen and paper out and write this number down. As the Record Turns, U.S. area code 323-251-4895, and that's astherecordturns.com. All right, so let's talk about Pink Floyd. Now, almost everyone here has at least a few of their records in their collection. They're ubiquitous. They're everywhere. Pink Floyd released some records that went on to sell 10 and 20 million copies each. So they're out there. And the music is still great. It's still timeless. And is an artist that I think so many of us have in common. So the album I'm going to talk about today is The Wall. And I'm just going to kind of touch on one little aspect of The Wall. But as most of you know, The Wall, it was released in 1979. It's, according to the RIAA, the Record Industry Association of America, Pink Floyd The Wall is the fourth best-selling album in history, clocking in at over 11.5 million copies sold. Now, that's a great figure, especially when you consider that it's a double album. So 11.5 times 2, it's selling over 23 million copies. So that's vaulted it to the fourth best-selling album in history. Now, Pink Floyd The Wall was very much a departure from what Pink Floyd was recording previous to The Wall. Their album Animals, Dark Side of the Moon, Wish You Were Here, those records tend to sound very different than most parts of The Wall. And The Wall tends to polarize people quite a bit. I know some people who believe The Wall is Pink Floyd's greatest work, and I know other people who can't stand to listen to The Wall. So it was very much an artistic chance that the band took, and I think most people would agree that it paid off quite well. In fact, it also helped spawn a movie based on the story of The Wall, which was a concept album which revolved around Roger Waters and his relationship to his parents and what happened to his dad and how he grew through life's challenges and whatnot, da-da-da-da-da. So anyway, that's the story of The Wall. I think most people kind of have a familiarity with it. Now, The Wall came out in 1979 at a time when secret messages on albums were kind of a big thing. People were listening to records and music and looking for deeper meaning and additional understanding, and they started to look perhaps in some of the wrong places. You may know about some of the controversy around Led Zeppelin, whether they put backwards messages in some of their songs, which is quite foolish, I think, we look at it nowadays. But then you have bands like ELO and the song Fire on High, who overtly put a backwards message just to tease some people. In case you don't know what I'm talking about, here is what the ELO message sounds like forward. And here's what that same section sounds like, reversed.
The music is reversible, but time. Turn back. Turn back. Turn back. Turn back.
So that was just kind of a quick example of ways that artists were taking advantage of the curiosity of the public for these sort of backwards messages. And the wall had its own backwards message. If you're familiar with the song Empty Spaces, you'll know that in the early part of the song, building up right before the lyrics start, there is a bit of gibberish there. And if you listen a bit closely, you can hear that it's actually someone speaking backwards. Now, if you spin that section backwards, here is what you get. So there you have it. Pink Floyd just kind of playing with us a little bit, toying with the trend of secret messages in music by just calling out, hey, this is a secret message. Really no meaning, no purpose other than just to kind of toy with people and play with their curiosity. So if you Google Pink Floyd, The Wall secret message, that's the information you tend to get. So when Pink Floyd, The Wall came out, I was in my very early teens, maybe not even a teen yet, come to think of it, doing the math here, probably 10 or 11. And we talk about the polarization of people who either love The Wall or hate The Wall. I absolutely adored The Wall, and I would play it over and over again. My father, however, couldn't stand it. He liked the early Pink Floyd stuff. He was okay with it. He was at least tolerant of it. But then you get the stuff on The Wall like The Trial and some of the more annoying parts. He just didn't identify with it, and it bothered him for some reason. So I had to listen to The Wall through headphones. So a good 5 or 6 years of my life was spent with the headphones on, just going through my brother's record collection, listening to anything I can get my hands on. And The Wall was an album that was on heavy rotation, in my head anyway. So during those listening sessions with the headphones on, I started hearing some noises. And there were voices. And I'm not saying I was hearing voices in my head, but I actually heard some sounds that were voices that seemed unnatural in the places they were at. And what I mean, let me describe for you where on the record these messages were at. As soon as you put the needle on song one, side one of the double album, that starts the song called In the Flesh. Now, as a prelude to In the Flesh, you hear this accordion music, this little melody that is actually the melody from the final song on the double LP, the last song on side four, which is called Outside the Wall. That's how that song closes. This is a clip of that accordion music that starts off In the Flesh and ends Outside the Wall. Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. Now, when you put the needle in the first groove on the first song on the first side, you will hear a little bit of a blurb as that accordion music starts. And it sounds like this. Okay. See, it's not just me. There's a voice there, right? Okay. Early on, I thought maybe it was a glitch. Who knows? But there was certainly something there. Now, going to the final groove of the record, I don't need to say the final groove. It's the final quarter groove, maybe. At the very end of the last song on side four, you also hear a similar glitch going out. So the very last sound that you hear on Pink Floyd The Wall goes a bit like this. Okay, did you hear it? Let me play it again. Here is the first part of the first groove on the first song of side A. And here is the last bit of the last groove of the last song on side four. Okay, so as a kid, you could imagine all I had was my record player and my headphones and just trying to capture these and trying to understand them and trying to catch the groove just right. And this was especially frustrating for the last groove of the album, because as soon as that groove played out, my automatic turntable arm would pull back and I'd have to kind of do that whole exercise again. So it was a frustrating experience as an early teen. So recently, I loaded those songs into my audio editing software. Just those last parts. And you know what? They fit together like puzzle pieces. So here's a clip of what the last groove on side four sounds like when connected together with the first groove on side A.
Isn't this where we came in?
So not only does the music go together, it seamlessly goes together, but the words form a sentence, okay? Now here's where it gets particularly interesting because I'm now going to just isolate that vocal part. It's on its own channel. So I'm going to pull out the music entirely, and here's what the voice says.
Isn't this where we came in?
Did you get it? I'll play it a couple more times.
Isn't this where we came in? Isn't this where we came in?
Now, as a kid with the headphones and struggling to try to listen to that bit over and over, I imagined those words were Sid is kept, or Sid is kept. That's what it sounded like to me. And the words on the first groove of side A were in Cambridge. So that was the story I concocted. And lo and behold, I think Sid Barrett actually lived in Cambridge and eventually died there. So I concluded that that was what they were trying to say. However, what I've recently learned now with these audio tools and being able to isolate this bit, the words that we're hearing are, isn't this where we came in?
Isn't this where we came in?
So essentially, with those words, isn't this where we came in, Roger Waters and Pink Floyd made The Wall one continuous wraparound piece of music, one that starts at the beginning, takes us on a long journey, and then drops us off right where we started to begin the journey again. It's quite clever, actually. Just another hidden touch of perfection on this album, which I love so much. Another fine detail in this landmark LP, if you will. And if you don't believe me, check it out on your own copy. But one word of caution, be very careful about cranking up the volume too much. You could accidentally blow your speaker or hurt your ears because, especially on side one, In the Flesh comes in with a big drum, bomb, bomb. And yeah, if you're not careful, you don't turn it down quick enough, that could really hurt your ears. Anyway, do you know of any other Pink Floyd hidden messages? Post them on our blog at www.thevinylguide.com or get with us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/vinylguide.
Isn't this where we came in?
So that's the first part of today's show. Now, real quick, hang on. We're going to get to our interview with Eric Spitznagel, who's the author of that book, Old Records Never Die. And believe me, this guy is great. You're going to want to hear these stories. This guy really tried to find his actual records from his childhood and had reasonable success in the process. So it's a great book, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy the interview as well. But before we do, let's hear from our friends at Groovewasher. Well, hey there, peoples. Let me tell you about an awesome product for cleaning your records. Groovewasher is the best manual record cleaner on the market. It's fast, it's effective, and it's kind to your pocketbook. You know how some record cleaners cost hundreds of dollars, and some machines even cost thousands? Bah, you don't need any of those unless you're doing like 50 or 70 records per day. It's a total waste of money. Get a Groovewasher record cleaning system now at groovewasher.com for only $55 for a starter kit that's shipped for free in the United States. The Groovewasher is a great way to keep your records clean, and I know because that's what I use at home. In fact, I recommend you checking out the Deluxe Groovewasher kit. It comes with some extra cleaning fluid and even a display block that looks very handsome next to your record player. Convenient if you want to grab it and use it very quickly and easily. So to get your kit today, simply go to groovewasher.com, check out what they have, pick the one that's right for you. That's groovewasher.com, and they are made in the USA. All right, for the second half of today's show, we are going to talk to Eric Spitznagel, author of the book Old Records Never Die, One Man's Quest for His Vinyl and His Past. And this is an absolutely great book. I urge you all to get a copy. It's such a killer book. And during the interview, Eric was in top form. But again, I must mention there is some saucy language in this interview. So if you take umbrage at the occasional swear word, well, be warned. Look, it's not that bad, but I've received emails from some people that have mentioned that they like listening to this podcast with their kids. So this conversation is probably not for the young ones. But for the rest of us, please enjoy the conversation and definitely order yourself a copy of Eric's book. You will not regret it. It's available on Amazon, and it's pretty inexpensive, too. I think the Kindle version is less than 10 bucks. Anyway, here is our conversation with Eric Spitznagel, author of the very awesome book, Old Records Never Die, One Man's Quest for His Vinyl and His Past. All right, we're here with Eric Spitznagel, who is the author of what I believe is a fantastic book, Old Records Never Die. And this is a book that I've been reading over the past few weeks. I love it. My wife hates it because I keep her up at night just laughing at these little lines and whatnot. So, but it is a remarkable book. Eric is an author, a humorist, a journalist. He's a self-described shut-in, and he's absolutely a record fan. Eric, can you tell us a little bit about the book Old Records Never Die?
Well, I specifically wrote it to piss off your wife. So it seems like I've accomplished at least that much. So hooray for me in that regard. It came about by accident. I kind of got the idea many years ago when I was interviewing Questlove for a website called MTV Hive, which is now long since defunct. But at the time, talking to Questlove about, you know, a memoir he had put out, and we got started talking about records because, as you may know, he's just a legendary record collector, and he has something in the ballpark of 20,000, something just ridiculous. And he mentioned to me that he has the first 45 he ever bought, that he ever spent his money on. I believe it was Sugar Hill Gang's Rapper's Delight. And he remembers not even like the day he bought it, but he remembers it cost exactly $3.16. That's what he exactly with tax, what he paid for it, and how he brought it home and listened to it in his living room. And it was just amazing to hear him talk about this record and how precious it was to him. And then he said, like, and of course, you know, I have the original one, which was fascinating to me that he still had this original thing from, I guess it was the early 80s when he bought it. And I was like, you never lost it. You never just, you know, I've moved many times in my life and crap just as a way of disappearing. And it's like, how did you hold on to this little piece of vinyl for so long? And he was trying to explain to me, like, you know, I'm not a hoarder, you know, but there are certain things in life that mean something to you. It's like, Eric, I'm sure there are a couple of records that are really meaningful to you. And I said to Questlove, oh, no, I've thrown all my records away. I, you know, sold them or got rid of them in the 90s. And he reacted to me like I had just told him, oh, yeah, I put the pillow over my dad's head and I waited for him to stop breathing. I mean, it was just the most horrified reaction. Like, I couldn't have said anything worse to him at that point. And that stuck with me. Long after the interview, I just couldn't stop thinking about Questlove and how he had made such a convincing case that records were important, that it wasn't just the music that mattered, but the object that they were on that mattered. And I started to have this gnawing sense of panic and dread that I had done something just horrible. Like, why did I get rid of these records? I have to get my records back. And it went from, I have to get my records back to, I have to get my specific records back. I have to get, you know, that those exact copies that I gave away. I don't just have to get, you know, the replacements Let It Be again. I have to get my copy of Let It Be, the one that with a certain scratch in Androgynous that I still remember and that it still smells exactly like weed because that's what I stored in my Let It Be in the 80s and 90s. It has to smell like specifically not just weed. It has to smell like weed from the suburbs of Chicago circa 1989. Like, that's, it was that specific. So I went on this journey.
So did anyone think this was a good idea?
No. Oh, absolutely not. And I'm talking everyone from my wife, who was probably the most supportive. And I think she was the most supportive because she thought that I would just tire myself out after maybe a week or two and just give it up. But everyone I talked to, like from record store owners to other collectors to people in my life, they all pretty much agreed that I'm batshit crazy. Like, there's no way it's going to happen. You're not going to find – you can go and get records again. That's great. But to find your exact records, their argument was like, that's like trying to say, oh, I lost my retainer in 1987. I hope I can find my retainer again. You're not going to fight it, first of all. And number two, that's fucking stupid. Why would you do that? So, yeah, most people told me I was just deluded.
And so how did you go about this? Where do you even begin trying to find your old records?
Well, luckily, the vast majority of the records I sold, when I say majority, like maybe 70%, were to this record store in the suburbs of Chicago, because that's where towards the end where I was buying most of them and when I decided to get rid of them, where I unloaded most of them. That was the good news. The bad news is that when I went back there, the record store was gone, and it had been replaced by a martial arts studio, which had no knowledge of there ever being a record store in there. And so that's when the panic sets in. That was going to see your old record store and it being replaced by a martial arts studio is the equivalent of like going home to see your parents, but there is like new people living there. It was really – that was that horrifying. Like, where's Dad? What the hell is happening? And they're, like, showing me around. It's like, this was where the punk section was. And this is where Iggy Pop was. And now there's a five-year-old doing judo chops. This is not okay with me. This is really uncomfortable. So from there, it was like, well –
Suffice to say that there were no records in the karate studio. There were none.
There were no records.
None.
No.
Okay.
And they only had a vague recollection that, I guess this building a while ago had used to be a record store, but, you know, they went out of business in like 1998 or something, and it had been empty, and I guess it had been something else, and then finally this martial arts studio. So there weren't a lot of clues about what had happened. So I started approaching it. Well, my first thought is like, it's over. There's nothing I can do. I'm doomed. But then my thought was, well, you know, you need to approach it like you're a private detective and you're chasing a serial killer. And there's only so many places these records could go. It's not like somebody bought some of my records at this record store and then said, all right, time to jump on a plane for Paris. I mean, it's got to be certain 30 miles this direction, 30 miles this direction. You know, they've got to be out there unless somebody burned them in a bonfire. They do still exist. So that's what kind of motivated me, was this feeling that like, yeah, I could find them. It's just, am I stubborn and stupid enough to go out and try to search for them? Am I willing to dig through enough boxes, knock on enough doors, dig through enough basements and crawl spaces until I find them? And the answer to that is yes, absolutely. I am stupid and stubborn enough to do that.
So in the course of this, how successful were you?
Well, that's open to debate. I know for a fact that I found one of them because it was undeniable, because it was a Bon Jovi record, Slippery When Wet, that has my first girlfriend's phone number written on it, which was amazing. When I saw it, I was like, I can't fucking believe I'm looking at this. And I had to confirm it because it had been 20, 25 years. I actually had to track down my first girlfriend to say, was this your phone number? Because I've been terrified to call it. Because, you know, what if someone picks up and you're like, hi, this is a guy who may have dated someone who lives there in 1987 and she was really into Bon Jovi, but I wasn't so much, but I bought the record to impress her. And long story short, can I come by? I mean, that just sounds weird, doesn't it? But I confirmed it with her. I visited her and, you know, brought the record, and she was like, "Oh my God, how did you find this? And I found it in some big warehouse record show. It was after searching through, it must have been like 1,000 records, and I was under a table in the kind of 10-cent box, which is all the records that, like, nobody wants these records at all. It's like they have like 20 copies of Phil Collins in terrible condition.
They're one step away from the garbage dump. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. They're about to be thrown out. Mm. And this, the Bon Jovi was just in terrible shape and covered in muddy water, dried, caked muddy water. And the phone number is so clearly, you know, not something most people, if you want to buy Slippery when Wet, you can find a better copy.
But that's interesting that you remember so vividly this record and the experiences you had with this record when you were young, that no matter over the course, 20 years later, you know, mud, dirt, debris, everything, you were still able to recognize it, kind of like a friendly face.
Yes, yes. Or like an old scar. I mean, that's what I miss so much about records, and why these specific copies were so important to me, that it really isn't just the music on there, that when you hold on to a record long enough, it there's something about the sleeve and the cardboard sleeve and the vinyl itself, that it's like skin. Mm-hmm. Like it gets weathered over time, and it kind of wrinkles and scars, and those scars are significant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those scars signify something.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right in your book when you start talking about the actual sound, the crackle, the scratches. There are records that I've had when I was young, and I went to buy copies of later because God knows what happened to them. And the magic still—it just kind of isn't there because it's just a little bit different. And however, recently I went back to visit my parents, and they had a few of my old records, and that was amazing. Looking at the labels and seeing the writing that I put on them, and that sort of thing. There's no feeling like that.
Oh, it's just electric. There's so much significance there that when I sold everything in the 90s, it just felt like I wasn't giving away anything precious. Because it was so certain, like, CDs are the future, and I love being able to. I never got into cassettes, because cassettes just seemed like something that you used to make the music that was on your vinyl records more portable, that you could walk around and listen to your records. But when I was in my house, I never put on a cassette. But in terms of getting rid of vinyl, I always felt like, well, if I need it, I'll buy it back. You know, but this is just junk that's weighing me down, and it's just and in every other aspect of my life, I don't wish for, like, oh, my childhood bed, or, you know, the Kiss poster that I had in my wall. I don't necessarily need that stuff, but records, if music was really significant to you, those physical objects really are significant, and they when you lose them, you lose something important about your experiences that were vital. And you know, my exact copy of The Replacements' Let It Be, which I don't think I found yet, but I think it's out there. And if I find it again, it's going to be one of the most significant moments of my life, because that is the record that got me through feeling like a really insecure teenager, and yet I had this record, and somehow it meant that I knew something all the other kids in my school didn't, and I was different from them somehow, and I had courage that I didn't have previously. And then it was a record I needed when my father passed away. It was a huge kind of emotional support. So not having that record anymore, I can listen to the music over and over again, but it doesn't have the impact of the way that record, that specific record, sounded, and how much it meant to me to kind of hold onto that sleeve. And it was like a freaking emotional life draft. It really was at times. I mean, when people talk about music saving their lives, like, that's not hyperbole. I really think that's true. And I think sometimes it's the record itself that's keeping you alive.
That's a beautiful way to describe it. What do you think it is about the nostalgia that we crave on this? I'm suspecting you're probably my age, probably somewhere in your mid-40s-ish.
Exactly.
And I think a lot of folks around our age are starting to do this. And perhaps this is part of why vinyl is making this roaring comeback. But what do you think? What's the deeper point of our mission here?
See, I have two thoughts on that. There is the nostalgia. There is the kind of yearning for your youth, but I don't think it's yearning to go back. I think it's a recognition of I shed away some of the things that were important that I shouldn't have shed away. That I in the same way, like I equate this with my father, that I wish I had been more involved with him and more attentive when he was alive. This record collection I have, which in my brain perhaps I've built up to be epic, but I wish I had it back because I would pay more attention to it. I would be more thankful for it because that kind of listening experience is so much more significant than I don't mean to sound like a guy in his mid-40s, but I love my iPod, but that's not a meaningful experience to sit with your iPod and thumb through songs. Not in the same way sitting down, even the most laughable music I had, when you could sit down there with an ABBA greatest hits and you are having a relationship with this music. When you were looking, I remember with my brother and some of our friends kind of debating the members of ABBA, like, okay, so their marriage is still working, but the other two, their marriage is falling apart. And like really being intensely into this, where now it seems like so much music is in the background. It's kind of the noise that fills the air as we're liking things on Facebook and, you know, updating our Snapchats and Instagrams, where, you know, back then you could realize that, like, oh, I spent the entire day talking about whether this ABBA album had an exposed nipple on it. And that was really important information, whether or not you could see a nipple on this record cover. And the other thing about age, here's something I'm very curious, which I've noticed about this. Records that to some extent, yes, there is the nostalgia aspect. Mm-hmm. But when I was going out looking for records, I noticed that they were in a lot of the record stores I went to, I was the oldest guy in the place. I think a lot of younger people in their teens and 20s are coming to records. And I hope it's not, it might be, but I hope it's not just a hipster thing, a kind of, you know, like
ironic sort of.
Yes. Thing. Yeah. Like, oh, it's cool because it's antiquated. I do think I have a lot of faith in the younger generation realizing that we have this amazing technology and digital music is amazing. You can have something the size of your credit card that can hold every song you ever imagined could exist, which when I was 22 was my fantasy. That was literally, I couldn't even imagine owning everything. I just thought about, oh, if I could just get enough money, maybe I could get that one Jimi Hendrix album. But to be able to go like, well, in 5 minutes, I can own everything he ever recorded, like literally download it like that. And if I have no morals, I can get it for free. It's just everything is available. And I think that there's a realization that there's something significant about records, not just because it sounds better, but because there's the experience of listening that you have with records that you can't have with digital music.
The ritual, the ritual, tactile,
the whole process of taking this black orb out of this cardboard sleeve and you slip it on there and you get the needle and you put it, like, do you want to start at the beginning? Do you know a specific song? Or you just let it drop and you hear that needle make contact, and then you're sitting in this room with this sleeve and you're looking at these images and connecting with the song. I mean, I with records, I have a relationship with music. With digital music, it's just something I'm consuming. It's something that's just every time I listen to music on my iPod, it's like, I wish I need 20 more of this. I need to go. I hoard it. I just want to get I feel like I'm victorious of somehow I have 5,000 songs. That's I won music. But with a record, you know, you buy the record, and even it doesn't matter if you like every song. Like, oh, I bought a new Iggy Pop record. I'm going to sit here and listen to this. And if I don't like it in the first time through, well, clearly I need to sit through it again and really digest it and put on the headphones and stare at the sleeve again and be mystified and horrified by Iggy Pop. And I just think that there's something there that it's not just about nostalgia, although it might be for a lot of people our age, but for some people like 22, 23, I am hopeful that they are thinking, you know what, records are more, I'm still going to have my iPods or iPads or whatever, and I'm still going to have my digital music, but there's something magical about listening to a music as a physical object.
And in a community sense as well. Like, you can't invite someone else to really enjoy your iPod music, but with a record or something, you could get, yes, a circle of your friends and kind of listen to it, and you could talk about it, but what you like about, yes, it, what you don't like about it, and then someone else can bring a few records and share those as well. So it becomes, you know, almost kind of a learning experience across multiple people.
It does. Some of my most wonderful moments growing up was when my Uncle Bob would play us music. My brother and I, he'd play music for us and explain it to us. And it was all bullshit. It was all just a tremendous bullshit. Like
he's the Bob Seger dude, right?
The Bob Seger fan. He loved, yeah, Bob Seger. He would explain Night Moves to us and kind of, I never saw him cry at his father's funeral, but he did cry many times during Night Moves. He really enjoyed that song. And he once,
the real whispery part, the woke up to the sound, yeah, of thunder, that part, that was the deep connection.
Yes. When Seeger is growing old and he realizes, yeah, when it kind of gets wistful and like, that's really when he started to tear up and he's like, yeah, you kids don't understand. We're like, yes, I feel like I need to learn something from you about Bob Seeger. And he would just tell me these stories, like American Pie was basically about his drinking buddies, which maybe he was being kind of, cute about it. But I took him literally. I thought he meant like American Pie is about my Uncle Bob and his drinking pals, and how like my uncle, he drove a Chevy and he drank whiskey. So it could be true.
His,
right,
story checks out.
Yeah, it all checks out. The song, he explained the song Gimme Shelter by Rolling Stones to my brother and I, and he would explain how the backup singer had a miscarriage and like somewhere in the middle of the song where she hit this really high note, and he'd like listen to it with us and go like, yep, that's where it was, that's when the baby just plopped out of her and just dropped on the studio floor. And my brother and I were just horrified by this, and we had no way of, you know, contradicting it or, you know, finding out if it was in any way accurate.
But you just took him for his word.
Yeah.
He was an older guy. He knew what he was talking about.
Yes. There was a mythology to music that, you know, no one had Google to kind of, you know, confirm or deny anyone's story. And these kind of things, you know, they took on a life of their own. And it kind of made the music more magical. I mean, it's all Greek mythology, really. I don't need the truth about Keith Richards or Bob Seger. I mean, the truth doesn't matter, but when you're telling these stories, it's around music. It was like, you know, when you used to go to summer camp and sit around the campfire and tell slasher stories. I mean, what would be worse than a campfire horror story than someone going, nope, I just checked out in Google, that story never happened. That's terrible. Who cares if it never happened? I don't care if there was, you know, a miscarriage in Gimme Shelter any more than I care if American Pie was about whoever it was about. Everyone tell me beautiful lies about it. I love that.
So let's say you do find this copy of the Replacements LP. Like what is, you'll revisit it. It's like an old friend. You'll play it. You'll cherish it. What do you hope to learn from it?
That's an amazing question. And that was kind of, in some ways, that was the big question of this journey as part of the book, because I I knew in essence that I was taking a fool's journey. I knew I was probably not going to mm-hmm. find these records. So it was really about thinking hard about what these records meant to me and why I needed them back so much. I think somehow it's hearing this again would help me reconnect with my past, but at the same time, like there's a learning process going through life, and music, if you love music, it's music becomes a big part of that. So if I kind of remember what it was like to be 17 and realize, hey, you know what? I'm okay. I'm incredibly insecure. I don't like my hometown. I don't feel like I fit in completely in high school, but for some reason, singing unsatisfied gives me a sense of security, gives me a sense of who I am. That maybe if I heard that again, especially being at this place in my life where I'm a father now, a father of a 5-year-old, I'm still grappling with my father being gone. I'm grappling with these adult responsibilities, with being offered a day job at a magazine, with which would involve coming to an office. I mean, when you have these transitions in life, music becomes your grounding force, and your musical history is as important as anything else that happened in your life. I mean, it was always strange to me when people told me, like, well, your wedding was like the happiest day of your life. It's like, not really. The happiest day of my life is when I listened to Let It Be and I really felt like a human being and comfortable in my own skin. Like, and that sounds selfish to say, but there are musical moments that really created who you are, I think. And, the weddings and those kind of moments are for the public, but those personal moments where you kind of created your self-identity, and music helped with that. So, I mean, if I got it back, I mean, that's kind of, I guess that's a vague way of answering it, but I think it would, by reconnecting with my past, it would give me a clearer sense of where I'm going in the future. I would find a touchstone that meant something.
Yeah. So, and I won't blow the ending for people because the ending is brilliant of the book. But you you did mention how you used that Bon Jovi record to reconnect with an old girlfriend. Were you looking for closure? Were you looking for anything? And did you find what you were looking for?
I was not really looking for closure, because it was not like I was trying to rekindle that relationship or anything. But I was looking for a connection with somebody who used to be important in my past, mm-hmm. and to kind of remember how I used to connect with people and how I used to have friendships with people and intimacy with people, and what it felt like to sit in a room with somebody who you cared about and listen to music. So there was, I mean, with Heather, my girlfriend, the significant moment for me was just watching her reach over to nudge the needle where she thought a scratch should be. And for some reason that was hugely significant to me, because the scratch wasn't there. It was, I had found a different record. It wasn't a Bon Jovi record. It was a Joel record that she was looking for a scratch on. And the fact that she was still looking for it, that the something that I thought had disappeared was still there. And I think only people who love the scratches on records mm-hmm. would find that as comforting as I do. When it's like you're someone who lost a limb and you're scratching that phantom limb, when you're still reaching out to nudge the needle on a scratch that's not there because maybe it's on your iPod now, mm-hmm. or maybe it's a different record, but when that stuff becomes so ingrained with you, that it becomes part of your memories almost.
Oh, yeah.
You'll always hear that scratch, even when the scratch isn't there.
When I was young, I had Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, like so many other people. And there was a scratch in the song Time. And every time I hear that song, I'm anticipating that scratch. And when I don't hear that skip, it sobers me. It's almost perverse.
So, yeah, I think just it was that weirdly that one little moment for me of us both acknowledging that that's where that scratch should be. Mm-hmm. That felt like, you know, I'd found something from my past that I had lost. And you know, Heather and I are still friends. We're getting together with our respective wives. She's happily married to a lovely, lovely woman now, which is an interesting experience. But I don't know. Like it showed to me the power of vinyl, the power of records, that I had been friends with her prior to this for a couple of years, and I felt like I knew her and I liked her, liked her photos and kept in contact with her. But it was like one afternoon of an evening of listening to records, and it's like, oh, I remember who you are. I remember that we used to be, you know, close, that we used to, that you have a human connection with somebody when you're listening to records with them, that, you know, scrolling through their photos on Facebook, you'll never have that connection. And the thing I often wondered, like, could I have just like gone out to eat with her, gone to a bar, had a few drinks? But I don't think it would have been the same thing. There's something about you're sharing this ritual together. You're almost having communion. You know, you're picking out the records. You're talking about the music. Some of it's nostalgia. Some of it's just talking about your lives, where you're at today. We spent certain times. I think it was what record was it? It was some record that was highly not appropriate to that, in which we were both talking about being parents. It was some some punk record, which it couldn't have had less to do with parenthood, that we ended up talking about that whole aspect. So it was really just the reminder of how powerful records can be in terms of helping human beings connect with each other.
On the music side of things, we're kind of that age to where the artists we listened to when we were young are starting to die off. This year, we've had plenty of examples of that. How do you feel when you hear news of one of these artists that you've listened to for years is no longer with us?
It's really disconcerting. It's very disconcerting. One of my friends wrote something on Facebook, of all places, that I really connected to, but for some reason many people were confused by it. She wrote, well, Prince is dead. I guess that settles it. We're not teenagers anymore, which for some that really sunk in for me. Like, Prince dying seems inconceivable, and everything about Prince makes me feel like I'm a teenager, and him not being on this earth anymore is I hate to compare it to my father dying, but it's one of those things where it's like, oh crap, I guess we are growing up now. Like, Prince is dead. I mean, David Bowie was really disconcerting, but Prince, I mean, I just remember holding hands with girls while watching Purple Rain, and everything about, I mean, countless dances to his songs. And I remember talking with friends about, like, Little Red Corvette. I think that's not about a car. I think that's about
another hood,
something else. Yes. And the first guy who was trying to explain to us that it was a metaphor for a vagina. And we're like, are you serious? That was a what? And then trying to wrap our heads around the fact that if it was, it was like, this is the perfect, like, bit of trickery ever, because we could like be singing this and our parents would think, oh, we're singing about cars. No, I'm talking about pussy, and my dad doesn't even know. It felt victorious. I mean, it was the ultimate committing a crime right under their noses, and nobody had any idea that, yep, it's a song about vaginas.
All the good ones are. So what else is so what's next for you? You've got a stack of records now. Some of them are from your childhood, right? Maybe not even childhood, some of your formative years. You've got the book out. Are you still continuing this quest?
I am, for a couple of reasons. One of them, I'm going to continue looking for my records. But it's become less about looking for the old records, and partly I'm kind of enjoying the search for records again, the way I used to, which is not flipping through hoping to see, you know, a record sleeve that it's damaged and just the exact way I remembered. But now kind of getting involved in it weirdly with my son, who is 5 years old now, and he's kind of developed this interest in record hunting. I don't know if he's going to go on to like vinyl, but he really likes going to record stores with me and flipping through records and finding like the process of finding records where it's all about like, look at this freaking trippy sleeve. Like, what could that be? What am I looking at right here? And he likes that. And I like doing it with him, and he loves discovering something. Which he thinks he's discovered. Recently, he thinks he's discovered Kiss, which I love so much. He is so much about – he wants to blare Love Gun to annoy his mother and I. And I just try – you try to do the parental like, oh, this is too loud. But inside you're like, yes, victory.
That's a great entry point for kids because it's kind of, Kiss is half music, half comic book. So it kind of gets –
exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
That's so true. So there's that aspect of just getting back into being a record consumer again. I mean, even just like 3 weeks ago, this happened, and I'm still kind of high from it, that I was in a record store and I heard some music. And I don't even remember who the artist was, but I'd never heard him before. And I started talking to the record store owner, and he's like, yeah, you should check it out. And not this record, but try this other record. And I bought this record having not heard a single song on it. And it was such like to buy a record based on a guy with a pot belly and a Metallica t-shirt, like who works for probably $3 an hour in a record store, is the most beautiful thing you can do with an afternoon. Yeah. And it was so fantastic. Yeah. And there's one other thing I'm doing, which I'm getting a lot of enjoyment out of, is as I continue to look for my old records, I often come across some records that clearly belong to other people because they've marked them up and they've put their names on them or doodles or there you can find some records with some interesting backstories on them. Like the first one I found that I held onto and I even wrote about it for Vanity Fair was this Lionel Richie album that had been marked up. It pretty much documented the relationship of Amy and Brian, who were a couple who apparently loved the song My Love, I think it was, and that they underlined it and then they pointed to it and Amy plus Brian. But then on the inside, Amy had written something about some other guy being cute. And then there was a huge picture of an erect penis. And I was like, what happened with Amy and Brian? Why did she fall in love with somebody else? And then Brian wrote the penis. I mean, how did they fall apart? Did they survive this other cute guy that Amy was into? I mean, I felt like I watched the relationship begin and then end in the course of a record sleeve. So I started this thing on I have a website, recordsneverdie.com, where it's called Missed Vinyl Connections, which anytime I've been asking other people to, if they find a record that looks like it has a backstory to it. I mean, whether it just has a name on it or, you know, there's some interesting records that we found and put up there. Like some people buy records and they cross out every song except one and they circle it. And like, what was it about that one song? So we're trying, it's the comedic conceit is that, hey, this record is out there. So-and-so, if you still want to find it, I found it at this record store in Portland, Oregon, or in, you know, Chicago or in New York City. And this appears to be, you know, it appears to be owned by this person. And here's what I assume the story was behind it. And the storytelling that can go on a record sleeve is fascinating.
That's interesting.
It's absolutely fascinating.
I've got some records where people have written their names on the cover or sometimes on the record label itself. And I've never thought to Google or actually try to search that. I've always secretly cursed them like, this is a beautiful record. Why are you defacing it? And now I'm looking at this in a very, after reading your book, looking at that sort of behavior in a totally kind of appreciative light, that this was someone's, this was a battle scar. This is an old war buddy of someone that just hasn't been reconnected.
I love that. And I hope maybe we'll connect somebody with their own records. I don't know, but I can't imagine I'm the only one out there who has a specific record they wish they had back. That there's a reason we mark up our records, and there's, you know, these are like, you know, oh yeah, I got Susan's name tattooed on my arm. Oh, crap! I wish I didn't have that. But that's an important scar that signifies something that was meaningful to you. So when you mark up Susan's name on a Santana album, like that Santana album was, you know, it was a witness to a hugely important part of your life, and reconnecting with that. And what I was thinking with the Brian and Amy, Lionel Richie album, even if they're broken up, even if Brian doesn't remember Amy anymore, or vaguely like, yeah, that freaking bitch, I just, the hell with her. Don't you want the record back? Don't you want that document of, you know, you used to, this was a moment from your life, which is never more clearly documented than on this, this piece of cardboard and this record.
And at that moment, Amy was the most important. This whole relationship was so important to you. And in the 20, 25 years since, you've now become happily married. All these other things have happened. And this is a witness to the growth you've had. It gives you an example of like, wow, okay, this is, you know, it's a bit of completion.
It is. I mean, at one point in your life, you loved her so much, you wanted to dance on the ceiling. That was beautiful.
You were willing to risk it all. Gravity and everything.
Exactly. Who cares? just embrace it. I mean, that's, you know, that's why, and going back, and my wife understood this too. And it's like, I'm going to go back and see my first girlfriend. Her first thought wasn't, oh, you want to fuck her? Is that what this is all about? But realizing that it's being reconnected with your past, it's not about like, oh, I want to have an affair. It's about whether it was someone I was in love with, or my, you know, my best friend in high school, my first college roommate. All these different chapters in your life were important, and going back and reconnecting with these people and having those musical moments with them again, I think you kind of get your sea legs a little bit. You get a better sense of what the world is like for you. And I recommend it to everybody. Anyone you've had a meaningful music moment with, go back, find that person, and sit down with them with those same records and spend an afternoon, and you will be shocked by what you discover. You'll be pleasantly surprised.
That's a great way to wrap it up. Eric, thank you so much. I just want to share that the book is Old Records Never Die by Eric Spitznagel. It is a hilarious book. We're only kind of touching the – pardon the pun – scratching the surface here. But there's a lot. The book is very deep. It's very funny. Do not read it at night while your wife's trying to sleep next to you. But any other time is perfect. And Eric, I've also – you know, check out his website. It's ericspitznagel.com, yeah? That's with your blog.
Ericspitznagel.com or also recordsneverdie.com is the one with the missed vinyl connections, which I hope people check out because it's
That's great. And I've been reading some of your articles aside that are non-record articles, and they really are quite funny. So we'll keep an eye on your future work as well. Thank you very much, Eric. We do appreciate it, and hope you find if anyone out there has a copy of The Replacements, Let It Be, that smells like skunkweed.
Really, it could be anywhere at this point.
Yeah.
I will travel to wherever you are to find this record, please. Yeah. Yes. If anyone has that,
please smell your records, everyone, especially The Replacements. any dirt weed smelling Replacement records, get a hold of Eric through his website. Very important.
Thank you.
No worries.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
It's like a long lost child.
Thank you for having me on. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview. Make sure to order Eric's book. I'll put the links to the Amazon pages on www.thevinylguide.com and, of course, our Facebook page, facebook.com/vinylguide. Go over there and join our community. I'd like to thank Eric for joining us and regaling us with his tales on his quest and wish him even more luck going forward. Also, check out his website, recordsneverdie.com, especially if you're Amy or Brian and looking for your copy of your old Lionel Richie LP. We know where it's at. There's also some very funny articles on his website and a video of Jeff Tweedy from Wilco talking about the book. So it's very, very awesome. That's recordsneverdie.com. So that's it for me. Again, visit us at www.thevinylguide.com. Join our Facebook page at facebook.com/vinylguide and tell your weirdo friends about this podcast. Have them subscribe as well. And until next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.